Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, Don, go away. I'm no good for you. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Volkbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. So today we're going to talk about space.
The final frontier.
Well, one of them.
One of the final frontiers.
Oh, I mean, there could be super space.
Right, yeah. What the space behind space.
Right.
Yeah, we're talking about space today because we wanted to talk about NASA's Dawn mission. If you've been following the space news, as I know a lot of our listeners do, you are aware that this spacecraft has gone in orbit around a dwarf planet, Ceres, in our solar system.
And that, Ceres, that's C-E-R-E-S, not like the Siri on your phone.
Right. So if you say, Siri, where is Dawn? It says, it will be in 8 hours. And you're thinking, no, you're just giving more questions. No, that's not the case. We're talking Ceres, the planet, and that, or dwarf planet, I should say. And that was after it had already visited another astronomical body, Vesta. And so we're going to talk all about what it did, why it's important, and what these actual astronomical bodies are, because it's a really cool story.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to start this story off pre-launch.
Okay.
Okay.
Like, all right, so like you know, 2000?
Like way pre-launch.
Like 1992.
Like circa the formation of the solar system.
Okay.
That goes back before my calendar.
Yes.
All right.
Yes, it does.
So that's going to be, what, like 4.5 billion years ago or so?
So 4.5 billion years ago. Yeah, okay. Sure. So none of us were there.
No.
I mean, I know that Jonathan
is old.
I
knew it. Oh, I thought I was getting away. I thought I was going to get away.
It only occurred to me to say because you made a point of, I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, that's okay. Fair. That's fair.
So at any rate, the leading theory among astronomers and physicists is that everything in our solar system was once just one big nebulous cloud of gas and dust and ice. Mm-hmm. And something would have had to have happened to kickstart the formation of all the bodies in the solar system, our sun and planets and moons and asteroids and et cetera. But we're not entirely sure what that is, but we think it might have been a nearby star going supernova.
It's really cool. It's one of those things I didn't really think about, the idea of what sort of circumstances would have led to all of these coalescing into what we know today. And the idea that it had to be, or potentially had to be, an external source of energy is really fascinating.
Yeah, I'd often heard about the formation of the planets, but I'd always thought about it in terms of how the planets and other rocky bodies and gas giants and things formed around the sun. So you have the idea of the protoplanetary disk.
Yeah, the sun already being there.
Yeah.
But of course, the sun has not always been there. It had to happen at some point.
Yeah, so, that's interesting.
So the radiation from this explosion could have like squished and pushed all the matter in this cloud nebula. You know, each bit formerly would have been at equilibrium, but suddenly they would be exerting their gravitational force on all the other bits in really new, exciting ways. And so as they started colliding and forming bigger, denser bits, they would have started orbiting around each other, and more bits would collide until the sun would form in the center, and gradually all the other stuff formed around the sun's orbit.
Neat.
Huh.
Yeah. Rocky bodies, some of them containing liquid water.
Oh, like, okay. So not Rocky Balboa.
No.
And not Rocky Horror.
Neither of those things.
Both have exquisite bodies.
They do. It's true.
Well, and they do contain liquid water.
That's
like
true.
Earth.
Also true.
Yeah.
So that's cool. No. Rocky planets, as we know, formed closer to the sun.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And gaseous bodies like Jupiter and all of that. Mm-hmm. Some of them having sort of rocky, really icy moons formed further out.
Mm-hmm.
And between Mars and Jupiter, the asteroid belt formed instead of an actual planet.
Which is pretty interesting, right?
Yeah, yeah. The leading theory right now is that not that there was a planet there, but it was destroyed by aliens or
right.
something like that.
Like that was Alderaan.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
We think that Jupiter's immense gravity mucked about with the planetation formation process and prevented I am inventing new words, Joe. Yes.
So in other words, Jupiter being such an enormous body with its own gravitational pull ends up interfering with the process that would allow these bits to otherwise glom on together and eventually coalesce into another planet.
Yeah, yeah. It just got right up in its grill and gravitationally speaking.
Jupiter is all like that. It does get all up in the grill.
So the asteroid belt contains lots of bodies of different shapes and sizes and compositions. And the two biggest are Vesta and Ceres.
All right. So let's start with Vesta. What do we know about that?
Well, it is a rocky asteroid.
I have heard Vesta has more in common with the inner planets of the solar system.
Yes. It was formed some like 4.5 billion years ago. Mm. It's the apparent surface is of basaltic rock, which is what happens when lava cools down really fast. Mm. So what they think happened is that lava would have oozed up from the asteroid's like hot, chewy center shortly after its formation and then cooled down pretty quick after that. It was the fourth asteroid ever discovered by human people. Huh. That happened on March 29th, 1807, thanks to Heinrich Wilhelm Olbers. I don't think I said that right.
Heinrich Wilhelm Olbers.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Of Germany, if you couldn't figure that out, y'all.
Don't feel bad. Jonathan served in Kaiser Wilhelm's government.
Shortly after the dinosaurs died out. I mean, honestly, my concept of time is somewhat elastic. All right, so how big is this thing?
It's pretty big. It is not small. It's about, and I'm about to read some very, very precise numbers here, 578 kilometers by 560 by 458.
Okay.
In miles, that translates to 359 by 348 by 285.
So sizable, sizable body out there.
Not really like planet or moon size, right. but bigger than a car.
Yes. Yes, 359 miles is significantly larger than most vehicles. Yeah. That's true.
It's almost a sphere, but does have this giant chunk that's 460 kilometers or 285 miles across and 13 kilometers or 8 miles deep that's missing from the South Pole.
Now that is one of the things that is particularly interesting about this asteroid body. It was one of the reasons why it was a great candidate to send a spacecraft to get a closer look, because there appears to be, this is a chunk missing. It's not like it formed and it just has this interesting shape. It looks like this is an area where something has forcibly impacted Vesta, and we ended up having the entire body reshaped from that impact. I mean, that's how massive it was. And also, this could end up teaching us more about some of the stuff we found here on our planet, right?
Yeah. We think that as much as 5% of the meteorites that fall to Earth come from that missing chunk.
5%?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Of all meteorites.
You're saying come from from Vesta.
From Vesta. Yeah. Yeah. Whatever happened that knocked that bit out.
Do you know how they determine that?
Actually, I do know, and I can tell you when we get to the part about the Vesta mission.
Okay.
So, yeah, so it's one of only three non-Earth bodies that we have a sample of here on the planet, the other two being Mars and the Moon.
Right. So, it was so neat that we ended up having this stuff, like, it ended up landing on our planet.
Yeah.
We know where it came from.
Yeah.
Or at least we have very strong belief that it came from that place. Like, there's not, like, a receipt. Like, we can't say, like, we could go back to Vesta and return it for credit. But we do know, and I'll talk more about how we know when we get to that part of the episode. So now we move on also to talk about Ceres, the dwarf planet.
Yes. Like Earth, it has a dense core and a lighter crust, and we think it might have a lot of ice beneath the crust and in the mantle. Because the crust is less dense than Earth's and also appears to contain all of these like water-bearing minerals and stuff. It might maybe even have just a wee bit of atmosphere, but We're not sure.
Sort of a, like a whiff of atmosphere.
Yeah,
not,
yeah.
Just not a, like a thick one.
Yeah, just an idea of atmosphere.
You know, it's kind of like a restaurant that's just getting started. It's got a little bit of an atmosphere, but they haven't really developed it yet.
Yeah. This Ceres was the first dwarf planet we ever discovered, though, right?
Yes, that happened on January 1st, 1801, thanks to Giuseppe Piazzi of Italy.
That was excellent pronunciation.
So, hold on. Now, would that would be including Pluto now, wouldn't it? That Ceres was actually discovered before Pluto?
Yeah.
Yeah. Pluto also being a dwarf planet.
Right.
Pluto's status changes on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, it's real independable like that.
We never know exactly what we're dealing with when we talk about Pluto, because by the time we record and by the time something publishes, things have changed occasionally. Yeah.
So, like we've said, Ceres is
about 975 kilometers by 909, aka 606 by 565 miles.
It's hard to picture exactly how big that is.
Yeah, no, it's
bigger than a car.
Significantly larger than any vehicle, yes. Yeah, no, it is difficult, right? I have those problems too, because you sit there and you think, like, how long would it take me to drive this distance? That tends to be the way we tend to think about it. Before we sent a spacecraft there, we had, of course, observed these. I mean, obviously, they were discovered in the 19th century, but we've since made other observations using other equipment.
Right. Well, we've used telescopes like the Hubble and ground-based telescopes that are on Earth or close to Earth. And the problem with that is when you're looking at very small objects that far away, it's hard to resolve them, even with a very powerful telescope.
Right. And there are lots of things we could potentially learn from a closer examination, which is precisely why this mission exists, right?
The Dawn mission.
Yeah, the Dawn mission, today. The NASA's Dawn mission. So first, these are protoplanets, and we know very little about protoplanets in general, apart from some hypotheses we have come up with. But, you know, without going in and taking a closer look, you can't really put those hypotheses to the test to see if you're on the right track or if you need to adjust the way you were thinking. And perhaps there is a different explanation for some of the observations you've made. This is the way science works, in other words. So that's really exciting. We'll literally be learning stuff we have not and perhaps could not have anticipated as we go into this. We'll also learn more about the formation of our solar system by studying these planets, which will give us a few more pieces to that puzzle of how we got here. And by we, I mean the entire solar system, not just the people in this podcasting studio. So that's really cool. Always getting more of a complete picture. I doubt we'll ever have a complete picture, but we have that desire to continuously add to our body of knowledge as far as this goes. And I think this will help us add to that. Also, the presence of water always leads us to the possibility that the planet may have at one time supported life, or perhaps there might even be a habitable ocean on Ceres. We'll talk about that a little bit later, too. And we may discover there's one hypothesis that suggests that a body like Ceres and a body like Vesta may have been responsible for the way the Earth is right now. And the idea being that something like Ceres might have been the source of the water on Earth, and a body like Vesta might have been the source of the Earth's iron core. So there's some theories
with
that
their
suggest,
powers combined.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They form Voltron, but Voltron in this case was Earth. So it's one of those things where the hypotheses have been proposed, but now we get a chance to explore this more directly and see if those still hold any, you know, value, or if in fact we have to reconsider our thinking.
So if we're just now reaching Ceres, and Ceres is very far away, we must have launched quite a while ago. I don't remember this launch.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you the story about how this launch came about, because it is its own really dramatic tale, like one that could have easily – like there needs to be a documentary to explain what happened, because it was – one of those things where for a while, I'm sure the leaders on this project were convinced that it was never going to happen, because they were thinking about launching a mission to look at Vesta and Ceres as early as 1992.
Oh, wow.
So that's when you said pre-launch. That's why my go-to first was 2000 and then 1992.
Yeah.
Now, NASA has these pitch periods where different potential missions can come and present to various heads at NASA and say, this is where I think we need to dedicate some of our resources. This is the sort of mission I think we need to do, and here's why. And they, the project leaders of what would become the Dawn mission, went before NASA three separate times in 1994, 1996, and 1998, but didn't receive any interest in their proposed mission. It wasn't until 2000 when they were selected as a finalist for a NASA Discovery mission that they finally had a chance to really to get like established as a mission. So that meant there had been 8 years that had gone by since they first came up with the idea to when NASA was saying, all right, let's really look at this as a potential mission, which also meant that the idea itself had evolved over those 8 years. They began to tweak it, perfect it, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So 2000.
That's crazy. I mean, in that span of time, you'd have to imagine even the science that informs the mission is probably changing.
Sure.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Technology, the things that we're learning just through other missions. I mean, all of that is making an impact, but it gets even crazier. So in 2000, they're selected as one of these three finalists, and they're to go to NASA in September of 2001.
Oh, no.
Yeah, 2001 September. So they're going to go and talk to NASA when the terrorist attack happens, and it cancels their meeting, obviously. I mean,
everything
was canceled because of that. So everyone goes home, and the mission, its future is put on hold. But after a while, things got back on track. The mission was picked up to be a Discovery mission. So it went from finalist to picked for a Discovery mission.
Awesome.
So now it's ready to go.
Yeah,
right?
Go.
On Christmas Eve 2003, the project is canceled due to budget cuts.
On Christmas Eve?
On Christmas Eve.
But Mr. Scrooge.
I know, right? Apparently, whoever was in charge of the budget was visited by three spirits and reconsidered. And also, another big thing that happened was the project partner, Orbital Sciences Corporation, offered to continue working on the mission at cost. So not charging anything that would result in a profit.
Oh, wow.
But providing their part at cost if it would mean the mission could continue. Oh. And things kept moving. 2005. So we're still not into the point where anything is launched yet.
Uh-huh.
2005, it gets in trouble again. The project's in trouble again because NASA administration changed. Now, I don't know if you guys have ever, you know, we've experienced this a little bit in our company, just one of those moments where you don't really know what's going to happen because there's a big change of leadership way above your pay grade, and you just don't know how that's going to trickle down and affect you. We've been very fortunate here at How Stuff Works, but I have also been at other jobs where a big boss has changed and suddenly everyone feels like they're defending their job. Like they have to justify why their job exists.
Sure.
The same thing is true at NASA with projects where there's a big administrative change in NASA. Often you have people who have to defend their missions, their projects to the new administration to convince them that this is in fact worthy of funding. And that started up again. So the project got shut down in 2006, but the Jet Propulsion Laboratory protested the shutdown. There was a review, and as a result of the review, the project was reinstated.
Oh.
So this is just like, I mean, this is, in a way, this part is more crazy than any of the science and technology behind it. It's just the fact that all these hoops had to be jumped through in order for this to even happen. So in 2007, the project finally got full approval, full backing from NASA, and it was officially official and stuff. So the team had hoped to launch the spacecraft between June and July 2007, but bad weather scrapped those plans. I know, right? It's like there was a black cat that crossed the road. They had to wheel the Dawn spacecraft under a
series
ladder
of ladders. And yeah.
A couple of mirrors broke on the way there. It was just crazy. But they were able to push the launch back to September 27th, 2007.
And it did go up.
It did go up. Everything was fine. And here's the cool thing. So, you know, we talk about things like missions to Mars and how you have a limited window when you can launch, right? Mm-hmm. Because of the way that Mars and Earth line up in their
and
orbits.
You want to get them when they're closest, sure.
Right. So that way you are expending the least amount of fuel, and thus you don't have to add more weight to your launch vehicle. There are a lot of reasons, right? I mean, it's a very big picture kind of thing. The Dawn spacecraft had a little bit more flexibility because it doesn't depend upon chemical rockets for its propulsion in space.
What'd you say?
Ion propulsion drive, ion thrusters.
What?
So we've
that sounds like crazy science fiction.
I know. We've talked about ion thrusters a couple of times in the podcast, and there have only been a few, relatively few examples of ion thrusters used in space missions. So here's what an ion thruster is. You use a gas. You are energizing a gas. You're essentially bombarding it with electrons so that those electrons can freely roam in that gas. That's when it becomes ionized. It can actually conduct electricity that way. The Dawn spacecraft uses xenon gas, and it emits this charged ion gas as exhaust. So that is what actually creates the propulsion, which is really neat. It means also that it has a very gentle but steady acceleration. So it doesn't – chemical rockets can accelerate very rapidly, right? And you can make these incredibly powerful motions, whereas ion thrusters, they are much more gradual in their acceleration. The flip side of that is that the top speed for a chemical rocket is much lower than the top speed for an ion thruster, because even though an ion thruster is going to take longer to accelerate to a really fast speed, it can continue to do so much longer than a chemical rocket.
Right.
Like a factor of 10 more.
Because it like uses its fuel more slowly?
And also it has a continuous acceleration thrust, as opposed to chemical rockets where you get that amazing amount of thrust at the beginning. But it's not something that can continue perpetually, because then you use up all your fuel. So, very much like it's because it's making very, very good use of the fuel. But this is the sort of thing that is not necessarily going to work well for every mission. It's good for particular ones like the Dawn mission. It's a perfect implementation for the Dawn mission, and it has turned out to be that way. So the ion thrusters came online on October 6th, 2007, and from the Dawn mission journal entry for October 7th, 2007. By the way, I don't know if you guys had a chance to look at the mission journal at all, but the project leader from Jet Propulsion Laboratories who wrote the mission journal, he is a poet as well as an engineer. Like, he uses such poetic language to explain what is happening, and there are now two bodies in the asteroid belt, one brand new and one ancient beyond words that are rendezvousing. I mean, it's like you're reading and you're like, holy cow, this guy must love science fiction, because he's got a really eloquent way of putting it.
Everyone that I read, either interviews or papers from connected with this mission, was just delightful to read. It was all terrific.
It's not dry engineering text, in other words. So if you are interested in this, I highly recommend going to the NASA website and looking at the mission journal. But this is an excerpt. This one is more of a technical explanation of the ion thrusters. While the three ion thrusters are the most familiar part of the IPS, the ion propulsion system, they are not its only elements. The system includes two computer controllers, only one is used at a time. When mission control selects one of the 112 throttle levels, each corresponding to a certain power consumption and thrust, the operating controller translates the command into currents and voltages that must be applied to parts of the thruster and the flow rate of xenon propellant to the thruster. The controller also provides the principal communications between the main spacecraft computer and the rest of the IPS, accepting commands and reporting on the IPS performance. While the controller is the brain of the system, the two power units, again only one is used at a time, are the brawn. Following instructions from the controller, a power unit receives power from the solar arrays at about 100 volts and converts it to more than 1,000 volts for use by the thruster.
112 throttle levels.
Yeah.
That 112 speed bike is what we're talking about.
Well,
yeah.
Wait, crazy doesn't it just go up to 100?
because
this one's 12 more.
Faster. Yeah. Exactly. I got to tell you, though, working the clutch gets a little sticky between 67 and 68. It does.
Okay.
You know,
well, you know.
You got to be a little careful on that
Everything
one.
Has its quirk.
So when it was using the ion propulsion as thrust, which it did not do for the entire journey, that would have made it go far too fast by the time it was reaching its destination.
Right.
But when it was using it, it was applying thrust on an average of 6 days, 16 hours per week.
Okay.
So out of every week, only you had 6 days and 16 hours of it being used as acceleration.
Right.
The brakes would be used for times when they needed to orient the spacecraft so that the antenna was facing back to Earth, so they could beam back engineering information just to make sure everything was going well.
Yep.
So that communication time obviously got longer and longer as the spacecraft got further from the Earth. Now, one of the maneuvers that the Dawn spacecraft made was one of my favorites in space travel, the slingshot maneuver.
Yeah, in February of 2009, it kind of ricocheted through Mars orbit in order to pick up speed on its way to Vesta.
Yeah.
Right, so it uses the gravity well of a planet in order to accelerate.
Yeah, which is, that's awesome, right? Whenever you can make use of the actual elements of space itself to help you on your journey and thus reduce the amount of effort you have to do yourself.
Awesome. It's sort of like a skateboarder in a silly action movie, kind of like catching the rear bumper of a car,
right,
and then using that car's forward momentum to drive itself forward faster.
Lauren, what action movie do you have in mind?
Back to the Future.
I was about to say, there was no word whether or not Power of Love was playing at the same time. So there's some other stuff that's aboard.
It has action in it. Sorry.
That's true.
Okay.
There's some other stuff that's aboard the spacecraft besides its propulsion thrusters. I mean, yeah,
Yes, the Dawn mission.
Oh, I was so hoping we could get through without having to talk about that.
No.
Well, obviously, from the amazing images we've seen already, it must have an awesome camera.
And a photographer. He's great. Obviously, it's an automated camera.
Yes. It was made in Germany. And it does not just take those pretty pictures. It's also being used for orbit navigation and is mapping the surface's topography and can even help us determine what the surfaces of these things are made of based on the reflective and refractive properties of the stuff down there.
Clearly going to be very important as we get to it a little bit later, right?
Yeah.
Yes. There's also a visible and infrared mapping spectrometer. Mapping the body's surfaces and helping determine their composition and temperature and properties. And that works, of course, by taking, very detailed note of the wavelengths of light that the surfaces are reflecting.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a gamma ray and neutron spectrometer.
Oh, good. So I can detect, like, the Hulk.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. The Hulk probably lives on Ceres.
It's a heck of a commute for those Avengers movies.
Constantly playing that sad music.
just walking with his thumb out and there's no one there.
Oh, sad Hulk. These are good for determining the precise elements that are present on those surfaces. And it works by measuring the effects of energetic particles that are bombarding the surfaces. I mean, there are so many particles out there in space that are bombarding everything.
Mm-hmm.
The researcher that I read an interview from likes to call it splat. Because that's just what's going on all over our galaxy all
that's
the time.
That's kind of awesome.
Yeah. So there's radioactive stuff on the surfaces. There's energetic particles bombarding the surfaces. And all of those create radiation coming up off of the not planet things. I keep wanting to say planets, and I'm like, no, they're totes not planets.
Yeah. Asteroid and dwarf planet.
It just seems like.
Well, if you wanted to be mean, you could say pseudo planets.
Ooh,
if you want to be diplomatic, you can say objects.
Objects.
I go with protoplanets.
Protoplanets.
Yeah.
At any rate, if you very carefully measure that radiation, you can extrapolate what must be down there. Either being bombarded or giving off that radiation itself.
Cool.
And then this is my favorite. They have a gravity science unit.
I first imagined that this would just be an apple, the gravity science unit.
Oh, I get it.
It was like a little,
took me a second
little
there.
Joke grenade for Joe there.
No, this sucker is our way of peeking into the object's interiors without actually landing on them. And, you can tell a lot about the inside of a space thing by measuring its gravitational field, especially if you've got some information about what is on the surface. You can extrapolate the density of the thing, and therefore the composition of the interior based on how the thing is pulling and pushing at objects that are near it. And the Gravity Science Unit does this using radio waves. Mm-hmm. So it bounces radio waves off of the surface and back to the unit. In route, the waves get Doppler shifted by the gravity of the thing.
This is so cool.
So by measuring that Doppler effect really precisely, you can figure out how much force the thing is exerting on the spacecraft from moment to moment, and then deduce some models about what must be in the interior to be creating that force.
Right, because of course we know that gravity is a function of mass as mm-hmm. one part of that, right? So the mass is also going to be dependent upon what matter is there and mm-hmm. the density of that matter. So if you're able to measure the gravity, you can start to make some good guesses about the nature of the matter that is actually there. That's really neat. I never really considered it that way. I would have thought, like, I tend to think of it the other way around, where you get a good idea of what the matter is, and therefore you can guess how strong the gravitational pull is going to be. Actually, you wouldn't have to guess. You would know if you know what the stuff is made of. But that's really, really interesting. So let's talk a little bit about the Dawn's mission and its encounters with Vesta and with Ceres.
Right. So before it got to Ceres, which it's orbiting now, it had a run-in with the asteroid Vesta.
Yeah. Not a little literal run-in.
It sought Vesta out. Yeah. This was an intended encounter. Mm-hmm.
They hung out for a while. You know, they exchanged numbers, that kind of thing. This would have taken place between 2011 and 2012. And, so in order to get to Vesta, Dawn had traveled 2.8 billion kilometers or 1.7 billion miles to get there.
So longer than the length of a car.
Longer than a car. The journey lasted nearly 4 years to get there. And it confirmed a lot of what we suspected about Vesta, which is fine. Like, it was, again, one of those things where we had some hypotheses, and this is a way of finding out if we were on the right track. So one of those was that Vesta is related to three classes of meteorites: Howardites, Eucrites, and Diogenites, collectively referred to as HED meteorites.
I've never heard of these before. Do you know what the difference is?
Well, there used to be Shimpites, but he left and was replaced by Diogenites.
Now, come on now, Jonathan.
You made a Dawn dish joke.
Okay.
All right, so the giant crater at the south pole of Vesta that Lauren was talking about earlier, it did suggest that perhaps there was some sort of enormous impact that blasted a huge chunk off of Vesta, and that chunk later broke into smaller pieces, many of which ended up entering Earth's atmosphere and became meteorites. And this was a way of saying, let's take a closer look and see if that, in fact, is accurate. They used spectral analysis, essentially, because we knew what the meteorites were made of, because they're on Earth.
Because we've poked them. We've poked them real good.
Exactly. Yeah, mm-hmm. We had a real good look at them. And so using spectral analysis originally from things like the Hubble telescope, it looked like Vesta was a really good candidate. And then using the closer look with Dawn, we were able to say that, yeah, it does look like this stuff is, in fact, the exact same stuff that we found back on Earth. All of that seems to be holding true. So that hypothesis looks like it's pretty accurate. Now, also we saw that Vesta seems to have kind of like an onion-like layering, and these different layers have different densities and compositions. So a big chunk, you know, you talked about how it was 8 miles deep on that south pole, means that several layers are represented by those meteorites. That's why we get different types of stuff.
It's like almost on the way to being a blooming onion.
Exactly. Wow, we're totally goofing off on this one. I love it, by the way. I'm not criticizing. I'm having a good time. So the mission also found evidence of hydrated materials, which sounds exactly what you think it means. Hydrated means there's some sort of water involved, whether that's water that's captured within certain minerals, not water like water pooling on the surface of Vesta, because Vesta was believed to be way too hot.
And not hydrated like Hail Hydra.
No, not that kind. Okay. You know, cut off one meteorite and two will rise to take its place. That is not the way it works.
Okay. Sorry, I interrupted.
No, it's fine. But one of the things about that is that the Howardites class of meteorites have carbonaceous material in it, meaning that it's carbon rich.
Yeah.
Now, carbon rich is one of those things you would not expect to find on a body like Vesta. You wouldn't expect to find water or carbon rich material. So what's up with that? I just said that it looks like HED meteorites have originated from this massive collision that happened in Vesta's past. How could that be if, in fact, this planet wouldn't have had carbon-rich material or water on it? Well, the thought is that whatever slammed into it did have carbon-rich material and water on it, and so some of it ended up going off into space and becoming other chunks of rock, eventually becoming meteorites that land here on Earth.
And some of it said, I think I'll stick around.
Yeah. So if you look at the pictures of Vesta, you will see in some of the images there'll be darker spots along it. That tends to be that carbonaceous material, the type of meteorites or the type of rocks that we're mentioning here. And so a lot of the study I've read, people have suggested that they didn't originate on Vesta. This was stuff that was deposited on Vesta as a result of collisions. Mm-hmm. So thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, after it left Vesta,
yep.
Dawn was on track to meet up with Ceres. So right now the Dawn spacecraft has entered Ceres orbit. It entered on March 6th, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Or did it enter on March 6th, or is that when we found out about it? Or I guess it'd be the same time. It's not that far away.
Yeah. It's not all that far away.
Yeah. I mean, it is very far away. It's not so far that it would take us like days to hear the radio.
No, I mean, even in Mars, you're talking like less than 20 minutes to get the information.
Okay. So it entered orbit around Ceres. Now, on the approach, it started getting some really good pictures of Ceres.
Yeah.
On Monday, January 19th, 2015, so a few months ago, NASA released some photos of Ceres that were taken on January 13th.
Mm-hmm.
And it was blurry, but you could clearly see, for example, a white spot on the surface of Ceres. It's something that seemed to be reflecting way more sunlight than the rest of the surface of the object. And this wasn't the first time that we realized there was a bright spot on the surface of Ceres, but suddenly we could see it a lot more starkly than ever before. And a lot of people started asking, what is it? And it's really cool because initially the scientists said, we don't know.
My thought was that it was the Hulk. He had fashioned a very highly reflective sign because the thumb sticking out wasn't working out, and it said, will work for gamma rays.
Nice. Well, so there have been subsequent photos taken with better resolution, and still we don't know. We don't know what it is.
Right.
It turns out there are actually multiple spots on the surface that have a much higher albedo, a higher reflective index,
mm-hmm.
Than the rest of the surface. And the main bright spot actually has a sort of dimmer companion right mm-hmm. next to it. There are other bright freckles, I've seen them called, on the surface of Ceres. You should check out the photos if you haven't seen them. Look this up because it looks really cool and really strange, and people don't know the answer yet.
Yeah, I love the one that has the pair of the spots, the bright one and the slightly dimmer companion, that are very close together. Like if your vision wasn't good, you might think it's one spot,
mm-hmm.
But it's two. It is two when you look at it more closely. And it is strangely compelling to see, because it almost looks like light is being emitted from there.
They're very bright.
They're so reflective.
Space.com wrote this up when the new higher resolution photos come out, and they got a statement from Mark Raymond, the Dawn mission director and chief engineer. And I love this quote. He said, we do not know what the white spot is, but it's certainly intriguing. In fact, it makes you want to send a spacecraft out there to find out.
Oh, hey, look what we did.
And that's what he said. And of course, that's exactly what we're doing. So as Dawn brings Ceres into sharper focus, we'll be able to see with exquisite detail what it is, what the white spot is. And I'm very excited to find out, because there have been all these conjectures, and people have said it could be cryovolcanoes
mm-hmm.
or ice geysers, you know, shooting up ice or materials from underneath in the icy mantle.
Mm-hmm.
Another idea I read, I think I read this in a piece on Io9 that was interesting, that said it could be exposed icy crust from recent impacts.
Right. So in other words, like you've got the thinner outer layer that got chipped away by an impact, and now you're seeing the icy goodness underneath.
Right. Yeah. So the other places where we're not seeing this brightly reflective surface are places where like dust has settled over time and it's sort of dulling the normally shiny surface. One can only imagine what it would look like if this is the case.
Maybe if we like polished it up.
Diamond. Yeah, that'd be awesome. I also remember seeing one person who had suggested that it may also be that it's deposits of some sort of highly reflective mineral at that particular spot, mm-hmm. which is also a possibility. That's one of the other things they'll be looking at. And they'll be using lots of different methodologies to test these different hypotheses to find out which ones are the ones that are accurate.
Yeah, I'm really excited to find out what it is. Now, here's a funny thing, a little peek behind the curtain, as Jonathan would say. We record these podcasts a little bit ahead of time, so it'll be really funny if they find out the answer between the time we record this and the time it comes out.
Right.
Hopefully that won't happen.
Yeah.
But this is today is Friday, March 13th, so if we just sounded like idiots, that's why.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's one of the reasons.
Yeah. Right. That's the specific reason why for this thing now.
Yeah. So there is another interesting thing that they're going to be investigating. And Jonathan, you brought this up earlier, is the possibility of oceans on Ceres, not even just oceans, but possibly habitable oceans.
Which is crazy awesome.
Yeah, right,
It does seem like kind of a far-off chance.
Sure.
It's not like they think they're likely to find this, but just the possibility is insane on something like, if you look at pictures of Ceres, it doesn't look like something that would host life. It looks like the moon. It's this kind of like crazy dead rock in the middle of space.
Mm-hmm.
But before the Dawn mission reached Ceres, scientists had suspected that a good bit of Ceres' mass was made of water. So NASA says that if 25% of Ceres' mass is H2O, is water, that would mean Ceres has more fresh water than Earth.
That's pretty incredible.
That's not more water, but more fresh water.
Fresh water, sure. Yeah.
So if it does have a substantial amount of water, is any of it liquid? And if it's liquid, could it support life? That might not be as crazy as it sounds. If Ceres does have a substantial amount of ice, the rock and the ice could separate into different layers, that onion effect you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And some scientists think that the icy mantle of Ceres was once an underground ocean. So
underground ocean?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, that's great.
Yeah,
it's
awesome.
Sort of similar to, though not exactly the same, but sort of similar to what you've heard about might be the case on Europa, where there there is frozen ice on the surface, but then probably liquid water underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's something that may be possible on Ceres, and we want to find out if that's the case. And if there is any liquid water, then there's always the chance that we could find evidence of life.
Which obviously be incredibly exciting.
Yes, I'm betting on cave-dwelling ice frogs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a piece you can look at in Science magazine called Dawn Probe to Look for a Habitable Ocean on Ceres by Eric Hand in February of this year. On top of the water, one of the other things we could do is learn more about the early formation of the solar system, like Lauren was talking about early on. These objects out in space can help give us clues about what happened when they were created.
And therefore, how everything was created.
Right.
And it may also lead to us learning about how the Earth got its water.
Yeah.
And the reason why this is also really cool is that the more we learn about these processes, the more we know what to look for when we're looking outside of our solar system. Things that if we know the various criteria that came together to form our solar system, if we can look for other similar systems, then that increases our chances to find other planets that could potentially support life.
And just getting more data about these things that we've only been able to study via telescope so far lets us check back in the data from those telescopes and see more patterns of where we got it right, where we got it wrong, and therefore make better guesses about other things that we're seeing through those telescopes.
It's awesome. It's so awesome. And one of the other things we can talk about that, you know, we have a little section in our notes about the future of asteroids. And one of the things I wanted to mention is that water, the presence of water is a huge, huge deal for us.
For many reasons.
For extended space exploration, being able to potentially harvest water from other bodies would allow us a lot more freedom, a lot more flexibility, and also creates the potential for things like terraforming down the road. If you're talking about bringing water in order to not just have something drinkable, but perhaps to help facilitate an atmosphere on a planet, that sort of stuff. I mean, this is a big deal.
Another big thing about the presence of water in space, one of the things we should mention is, well, we've got plenty of water. Why don't we just take some water into space? Well, it's really expensive to ship stuff into space.
Right. Taking water gallons, is heavy.
Yeah, gallons and gallons of fresh water is not a very smart way to invest in your payload. So if you could actually access water once you're already out of Earth orbit, That's a really cool thing. So asteroids that have water on them could be harvested, like you said, not just for drinkable water, not just for terraforming and stuff like that, but to make rocket fuel.
That's
in
also,
space.
Yeah, it's
because
also true.
Water has hydrogen and oxygen, the chemical elements you would use to make certain kinds of rocket fuel
right.
that we use in our reaction drives today.
And while you might argue that we have plenty of water right now, it is a limited supply. It's not like we're getting tons of water from outside sources. So if you keep shipping water off the planet,
I probably wouldn't be worried about that for a while.
No, I wouldn't either. I'm just thinking really long term.
Okay. Sure, sure, yeah. The Earth's water cycle is closed.
Yeah. Now, if we were to, say, end up siphoning water off of asteroids to bring it back here, that seems like it would be a pretty enormous effort. I would have to think the stakes would be incredibly high for us to put forth that kind of investment, but never say never.
No, I think it's more the idea that we would use this in space
where we don't
have access
to
Earth's
water.
Like
if we were to create another space station further out from the Earth, this would be a great source to be able to get water. And of course, we would still be implementing the same water reclamation programs that we have on other types of spacecraft to extend the use of water as long as possible, because you know, just because you have an access to it doesn't mean you
just because you can stop by the Ceres Quickie Mart and you know pick up a few gallons,
just see a bunch of astronauts just brushing their teeth with the water running, just blobs of water just floating around like crazy. We can get more, it's just right over there.
That makes me think of a crazy question. I can't believe I didn't think to look this up beforehand. Could you walk on Ceres? Does it have enough gravity that you could actually, you know, walk around on it?
That's a
don't
good
know.
Question.
I suspect it does.
It would have to be. It would be. I mean, it is definitely. It's smaller than our moon.
I just looked it up real quick right now. It looks like the gravity on Ceres, the downward acceleration is 0.27 meters per second squared, whereas on the moon it's 1.6 meters per second squared.
Right, and the moon is 1/6 the
right.
Earth's gravity.
Earth would be 9.8 meters per second squared.
So very little gravity.
So don't jump real big right. like that.
Yeah, you might regret it.
I was taking a stroll on Ceres and everything was nice until I sneezed, and the next thing I knew. But at any rate, we've been fascinated with this whole story, everything from all that went into getting the mission together before it even launched to the stuff that we're seeing now, the images that are returning and the information that's returning from the mission. And also we should point out this is an historic mission for another reason. It's the first spacecraft to visit two different protoplanets at all. Like, not only the first one to go to a protoplanet like Ceres in that sense, but to go to two different ones.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a cool thing as well. We will keep our eyes on the news that comes out of the mission. And like Joe said, I hope that this episode comes out before any other breaking news. if it turns out that there's some major thing that happens between when we've recorded this and when it publishes, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's not like we're going to be unhappy that it happened. We'll just be unhappy that we look dumb.
Yes.
So, but this was a really fun topic to cover. I mean, we always love covering space topics. It's one of our favorite subjects to cover on here. Space, AI, and 3D printing. That's kind of our bread and butter. But of course, we love all topics about the future. So if there's anything out there that you, dear listeners, would love us to cover, maybe there's some topic that you're just dying to hear more about, I invite you to write to us. Let us know what you want, and we will be happy to look into it for you. Our address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com, or drop us a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Google Plus. Twitter and Google Plus, we are FW Thinking, and over at Facebook, just search FW Thinking in the search bar. We'll pop up, leave us a message, and we'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.